Committee on Education, Subcommittee on Higher Education for Wednesday, March 14th, 2007. We are fortunate to have representatives from the Oregon Student Association and Oregon University System and Community Colleges here to talk about student services and continuing our education on your educational systems. At this point, can we have the representatives from the Oregon Student Association come forward?
Thank you, Chair Buckley and members of the committee.
My name is Michael Olson. I'm the student body president at OSU and a member of OSA.
And I'm Courtney Morse. I'm the student body president at Portland State and an OSA board member as well. I'd really like to thank you for allowing us to have this hearing. We really wanted to paint the picture with you and talk about student services as a critical piece to student success and examine the impacts that the cuts have made, and so we're really glad to have this hearing. So, thanks.
And as she said today, we're just going to run through some of the important information and facts that really help to support the need for student services and retention. So first off, looking today at retention and looking at specifically freshmen, first-year students, they have only a 58.7% retention rate or graduation rate. And so looking at then the second year, students that make it into their second year within the universities have a 71.7% graduation rate. And it's important to highlight that because, as you see, they have a much greater chance as they enter into their second year of actually graduating with a degree. And so a lot of the services and student services that exist really do help with retention and really do help in the freshman year with orientation and advising. So it is of the utmost importance to retain all of the students as possible and to get them into their second and third year.
And a great example to look at models that have worked is the TRIO program. And so we wanted to highlight the impacts that the TRIO program has had on a specific group of students. And it's a program that really works to have, you know, a staff-to-student ratio that's very low, very intimate. And so it's amazing results. And we look to really replicate this. Were we to have that funding for those additional resources, were we to have the funding for these services that are being cut? And so, for example, the TRIO program at the Lane Community College in Western are really proof that these are a tool for retention. Students there have a persistent rate when they go through the program of 90%, as well as 98% of them are in good academic standing. And so really looking at this program, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, Western had a 54% graduation rate. And so what the program does is it really targets those at-risk students, helps them with tutoring, mentoring, advising, and has that intimate connection that really proves to be very successful. So we look to have those programs. Were we to have the adequate resources, it would be amazing if we could imagine what these kind of programs would do at all of our college campuses.
Terrific. And next, in a recent study called What Works in Student Retention and Four-Year Colleges, they clearly identified some of the barriers to students attaining a degree. It breaks down inadequate financial resources, lack of motivation to succeed, inadequate preparation for college level work, too many job demands. Students are obviously having to work more and more to afford to stay within the universities. Poor study skills, lack of educational aspirations and goals, and poor academic integrity. And the reason it's important to highlight these is because these are the many things that can be solved through student services. When you're talking about inadequate financial resources, having more financial aid officers to help with financial planning, when you're talking about poor study skills, the ability to provide tutoring and advising, and a lack of educational aspirations, it really does start your freshman year with advising to really get the support and the resources to help you realize what aspirations and goals you can attain. And in terms of poor academic integrity, it's of the utmost importance to have a strong student affairs and student life program that really does provide an atmosphere of integrity within the university.
And so, you know, student services have seen drastic cuts, and we're going to talk about some specifics on some college campuses to give you really a picture of all over Oregon, how this is affecting our campuses. And so we know that student services are really not enough, and here are a couple of statistics that really point that out. Once again, the overall graduation rate for OUS FACS in 2004-05 was 58.7%. So students are going to college, and they're dropping out because they have, you know, loads and loads of debt. Personally, I'm sure you've heard this before, I'm $30,000 in debt. I have a private loan I have to take out with an interest rate of 14.25%. And so I was faced with the decision to either continue to go to college and continue on this path of lots of debt, especially because I want to work in the nonprofit industry. So I really met with an advisor who was able to give me those skills, but I was, you know, fortunate to choose that. But a lot of students are having to make the choice to actually drop out because they're not getting those services to retain them, those resources. And so we know that a lot of students are dropping out or just graduating longer. 4.6 years to graduate is the average at a four-year university. And we know that community colleges face specific risks for these. So we know that the cuts to student services have really contributed to this issue of students dropping out and taking longer to graduate.
And it's important to highlight that in talking about retention rates and graduation rates, that there is really an inadequacy. There's not an even distribution within these graduation rates. And if you look at here a sample from 1977 to the year 2003, you can break it down into socioeconomic status. And if you look at the top quarter of the total income, those people in those brackets saw an increase in in graduation rate of 39%. So you're really seeing that top quarter of our population having an increase in graduation. And when you break it down to the bottom quartile of our socioeconomic status, they only saw a 3.5% increase in their retention rates. And as Courtney pointed out, it's becoming more and more important for students to graduate, seeming as the cost that they're having to take out. I mean, $30,000 in debt is a tremendous amount to not be earning a degree with. So it's just important to highlight that. You can also break it down in terms of people of color. When you look at, and actually on this slide it could be important to note, this is supposed to be from 1995 to 1996. We don't like to go back in time to 56. So,
especially 40 years.
Yeah, slight error. But noting that, if you look at the graduation rates for Asian Americans and Caucasians, you saw a graduation rate of almost 60%. And looking at African American and Latino graduation rates, is closer to 40%. So there's a huge inadequacy between these different populations. And highlighting this is important because many of our student services work to reverse these trends. And this just shows how important it is to maintain these services. And while we are trying to keep the cuts out of the classroom, we really do need to be putting the resources into the student services, such as our Minority Education Opportunities Program, the educational opportunity programs that we have at OSU that really are targeted to these low-income students, to people of color, those at-risk populations that really do have statistically a much lower chance of graduating and earning their four-year degree.
And as Mike mentioned, you know, the cuts, we're really having to make choices at our universities, and we're going to highlight some specific choices that we've had to make in cuts. But, you know, administrators are unfortunately having to decide to keep the cuts in the classroom or outside the classroom, and these services are proving that both are critical pieces to a student's success. And so we would like to highlight a couple examples, but that's just an overall picture of the drastic cuts that are happening all around our state as far as student services. For example, I'd like to point out Southern. Actually had $705,000 cut from admissions, registrar's office, financial aid, the Access Center, and the Office of Student Affairs. And if you've heard before, Southern is having a problem with retaining students. We know that these services, you know, are attributing to that. And if they had those services, they probably wouldn't be facing a lot of those problems.
And just to talk a little bit about OSU, we've seen recently a $340,000 cut in our student affairs budget, which does support all of our student services. And that's across the board. That was really absorbed in cutting costs as much as possible in as many areas, cutting corners. But we're at a point now where we're actually in a $1 million deficit, and that's been a huge conversation for myself and the many students that are involved in leadership on our campus, because it's really like, all right, what are the effects of this going to be on our campus? And working with Dr. Roper, our Vice Provost of Student Affairs, and identifying, okay, what areas are we actually going to be cutting here? Because we're not talking about reducing costs in certain programs. We're talking about removing programs. We're talking about cutting faculty and administrators within these programs. And so we had a huge conversation on our campus, and our Senate actually voted to support an additional fee for our students on campus, because we, and I wish you could have been there to hear the conversation, but unanimously everyone identified that these programs are too vital to the student success, to the student experience. Many of them had personal stories of how these services helped retain them, they helped make them feel welcome, and really helped to make them successful in working towards their degree. And so it was actually extremely powerful to see these conversations and to see students say, you know what, we are willing to take on this burden because it is too important to our campuses to have all of these services. So we actually did recently support having an additional fee, which is continuing the trend of increasing tuition, increasing additional resource fees, and this is just yet another example of students having to take on this burden. But it really does identify, you know, how important it is for there to be funding for these programs and retaining these. And a $1 million deficit is a huge issue for us to have in this area.
Mr. Chair.
What was that agreement?
Is it accidental that there's no PSU line on this, or is it just that you didn't get the data?
Chair, Representative, I was just going to highlight that PSU actually had to make the same choice. They didn't do cuts in student services. But if you flip to the next one, what happened is we actually increased our matriculation fee by $50, as well as we implemented a $7.50 fee per term to fund these student services. And so our administration at PSU made the choice to, instead of cutting these student services because they were too vital, to actually just increase a lot of the student fees, which is what Mike just talked about, is that we determined that these services are way too vital to be cut, and we'd rather have students pay for them, unfortunately, to keep them around. Another example we wanted to highlight is you may have seen the student profiles that we send out, and we wanted to highlight that one of the profiles that we just sent out, a student named Jessica Rojas at LCC, which we all know community colleges face even more important issues of student services. She actually had to drop her Spanish courses because the tutoring was no longer available for her to succeed. So this is a student who's paid for those classes, is expecting those services, and now all that money is pretty much on twist because she can't finish her Spanish classes. She needs that extra help in that tutoring. And that's just one example of the many profiles you might read that really brings a face to the issue.
Just to add to the conversation on the OSU campus, it was a conversation such as our counseling and psychological services. We've really felt the mental health of our students was extremely important, and it was identified that there would be reductions of at least two of the psychiatrists there that were providing support, and so that's just one specific example of cuts that were going to be happening. So what do we need as students, as a university system? We really do need to see a backfill of the cuts to our different student affairs and student life programs, things such as admissions and financial aid, counseling and tutoring. These are all important, and they all have seen cuts, and so backfilling these cuts is extremely important. We need to come up with new and innovative ways to provide students with these student services. I think that goes right in line with additional funding or backfilling. And I know that's something that's happened at OSU, that over the last 8 months on our campus, the Student Affairs Department has gotten together with all of the different department heads and tried to come up with a reorganization of our department and our student affairs so that they can be sure that they're providing the most effective services, that they are being cost effective. And it's actually been a really good thing because it's allowed us to identify what are some areas that need improvement that can happen by reorganizing. So it's extremely important that goes along with it. We also need to refocus on retention, ensuring students have the tools that they need to succeed. I think a lot of what we've provided you today really does support the notion that we need to focus on those areas, because retention and graduation is extremely important, and I think that's what every student is working towards. And I think a 58.7% graduation rate overall doesn't get us where we need to be as a system. So.
And always to mention the important, unique services that community colleges provide for our workforce. It's always important. They need that fully funded budget. They're especially at risk. But in talking about the overall picture, the Oregon Student Association, we as students have made the choice to prioritize these services, whether it's the fact that on our campuses we've chosen to pay a fee to subsidize these cuts, or whether it's as a board we've decided, you know, if we were to prioritize one issue, and I'm talking about how we would like to spend the interest earnings, the $19 million, we've said that we wanted $10 million of that to go towards student services. And so we've provided you a lot of information, but this is a priority for students, for administrators on campus, that these services are way too vital. And so, you know, it's not just talking about the problem, but the solution. And that money, that funding, would help these student services, would help retention, which I know is a big concern for a lot of students, to be successful in Oregon and to contribute to their great state, even though they are in debt. We need them to, you know, walk them through the entire process of success as a student. And these services are vital, and that funding is vital to this. I'd like to thank you for your time, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen?
Mr. Crum.
I have a few, if I may, Mr. Chair. But I'll be quick. On the first page, this says a key to success is persistence. You have 58% of all freshmen, and then 71.7%. Is that 71.7% of the 58% if a person persists through all the years of school, obviously their chances of graduating become higher. Mm-hmm. So is that like 71%? That's 71% of the 58% who moved on.
Yeah.
And 81% is 81% of the 71% who moved on, correct?
I believe that's correct, yeah.
Because the 71% now becomes
100%. That is not correct. I apologize.
That's not correct? Because you can't have...
Oh, that's the graduation rate of those students. So those students who make it through their first year have graduated at a rate of 58.7%, and then those students in their second year graduate at a rate of 71.7%. So it's not necessarily, this isn't, am I right on that?
Right, identifying, clarifying.
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Student Association. And what he was saying was almost correct, and said the graph just shows that out of all freshmen that start, 58.7% of them graduate. If you get to your first year, if you get to your sophomore year, or you persist past your first year, 71% of people who persist past their first year graduate. 81% of people who persist after their second year graduate. And then 76% of community college transfers graduate.
Okay.
So it just kind of shows that the first year and that set, and you know, every year you persist on, the more likely you are to graduate. And so you need to put resources and make sure that students have the resources they need at the beginning to persist on. Because students who don't persist on are more likely to graduate, not to graduate.
Okay, thank you.
Follow up, Mr.
Beacon. What is TRIO?
TRIO is the federal program it partners.
But what does TRIO stand for? What does the acronym TRIO stand for?
Jeez, I forgot too.
So musical chairs for.
Don't have it at our campus, so I don't know.
Retention.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Chair Buckley and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Holliday. I'm the Vice President for Student Affairs and Enrollment Management at Oregon Institute of Technology. I'll be up here again in a few minutes with my colleagues. TRIO is a set generally referred to as three sets of student support services grants to higher education institutions to serve the highest risk students that are attending those colleges.
But isn't this is written like it's an acronym?
It may be an acronym, sir, but it really refers to three distinct student support services grant programs out of the federal government.
Okay, thank you.
Is that adequate? Thank you.
Thank you. Just a second. I'm almost there. On the page that says at least the cuts are not in the classroom, right? How much of these services are coming from general fund, which we control, and how much of those services are coming from the student fees that each institution controls?
Chair, Representative, I think it differs at each campus. So, for example, PSU, we had to increase some of those student fees to provide those services. And so some of these funds are, you know, part of the university to allocate from their general fund. And if there's lack of those funds from the state, that's when universities are having to think of creative and innovative ways to come up with those. And usually it means increasing either resource fees or matriculation fees. And so, you know, we're talking about a lot of different services, everything from RA programs, for example, at Portland State, which we had to increase our resource fee and to allow that RA program to exist. So, you know, it differs, I think, at each campus, and it differs with kind of how the university wants to prioritize which programs it can save and which it can't. Does that make sense?
Cool. Okay, thank you. And then the one last thing, question, and this is really more of a rhetorical question, Mr. Chair, and that is, I worked for a company one time that decided that there shall be no more sales until revenue's improved. And what I see here when I see universities cutting the admissions office kind of reminds me of that. I mean, how do you improve things and recruit students and increase your fees if you're not outselling your program, if you're not admitting, if you don't have a strong admissions office? So that kind of reminds me of that.
But
you know,
if you lose money on every sale,
right?
You have to have more sales.
So is it no sales is worse than, I mean, is almost better than no money? Not enough money on each sale? Okay. I'm just a reporter.
You make money on each sale and you make it up in volume.
Yeah. Chair, Representative, I know it was rhetorical, but if I could add, you know, for example, PSU enrollment has gone up, and, you know, administrators, we actually have less. So more students are in the lines with less services. So that's a good example of what's happening.
And maybe to add on to your previous question about how much is coming from general funds and how much is coming from students, at OSU, if I have the numbers right, I believe from the general budget, we have about $4.5 million coming from the general fund to these different services. And I believe with the student fee, we have about $12 million coming in to support programs. So,
thank you.
And actually, I could probably give you, I have a packet here I could probably give you.
Thank you very
much. Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Representative Klein.
On that last note, I haven't seen a bill this time to rename Oregon State University to Oregon Student University to reflect that. Is that an intentional oversight, or what do we got?
Well, Representative Clem, I think that's in the back of our mind to maybe use at a later point.
I did have a serious question.
Representative Bill.
That's unusual for me. Nice tie, by the way, Representative Clem.
Thank you.
Yeah, we got student body president right there.
Exactly.
I just am wondering about both of your feelings related to what you have achieved and learned and what's helped prepare you for what you're going to do next in student life, non-classroom, versus student life in classroom, because I certainly got a lot of experience through student government and other, you know, living groups and things. It wasn't something that happened in the classroom, but I'm sort of interested in your overall education. How do you feel about...
Spoiled you forever. That's why you're here.
Yeah.
Chair, Representative, I think that's a great question. Through this process of just working through this session and testifying and lobbying, as well as the fact that I've been involved in lots of grassroots organizations on campus, I've learned so much about the legislative process this year. I've gained critical skills in managing staff, just running student government, running grassroots campaigns, and these are critical skills that I hope to put on a resume, hopefully with a degree. No, I know I will have that degree, but, you know, who knows what I'll do with it, but I know that being critical experience, and I find it kind of priceless, and the classroom education complements a lot of what I learn outside the classroom, so I think it's a really great partnership. It's why we always encourage students to get involved with these extracurricular important opportunities.
Yeah, I think obviously the experience that I have gained has been invaluable and has provided me skill sets that I could have nowhere else obtained, but I think it's less important to even highlight myself as an example, but more so the average student who even just gets involved in the internship program that we provide through our student government or gets involved with the club on campus. It really does help students to enrich their life and their experience at OSU and the different universities, and it really does provide them great opportunity in the future as they gain skill sets in organizing, being part of groups, spending time outside the classroom, meeting people, and just those interactions that you have outside the classroom, because not always do you get great hands-on experience or that well-rounded experience through your academics. And so, I mean, for myself, I always highlight that the most I've ever gotten out of my degree will be my experiences outside the classroom. Mm-hmm. And I think that's for a lot of people, but it's not just me. It is even that just average student who steps outside the classroom and gets involved. It's extremely important, and having these programs, student services, gets students there, gets them outside the classroom, provides them the resources to succeed in the classroom so they can do that. So, yeah.
And follow up to that, Paul?
Mm-hmm. I think those are both excellent answers and sort of what I experienced as well. And I think it also, if you go back to your matrix of characteristics making the greatest contribution to attrition, it anchors people as well. And I think that's the bottom one, poor academic integration, that, you know, if nothing else is going well in class, if you're part of the, you know, Chinese Student Association and you know there's a cultural night there, that's going to keep you thinking, I don't want to leave school and go back home. I want to finish for something else, but it puts you back on course with your books as well, I felt at least, and because I didn't get involved in student government for a couple of years, but still student life in general and your friends and those, they make you remember why you're there, which is school, but they help you stay there too.
President Lin.
Thank you. Chair Riley. Buckley, I'm sorry.
That's Irish enough. It's close enough. Riley Buckley.
Okay. The student of color trail behind the graduation rate. And is this the poorest college are we talking about, or community colleges? Graduation rate.
I believe that's the universities.
Universities. Okay. Then my question is, why the Asians that the highest out of these four groups, and Asians are behind under the Caucasian for the economic factors, but the education-wise, they are higher. And why can you, why do you see that? How that happens?
Chair Representative, I don't know offhand, but the study is cited here, and we can definitely follow up with the reasons, and I'm sure the study will have more examples for that fact. I think it's interesting as well. Do you have anything you want to add?
I think you're delving into an issue that definitely I am not in a place to explain, but I think it would be very interesting to look into, and we'd be more than happy to do that.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just want to comment. Sometimes we are relying on socioeconomic factors because poor people are always behind, not going to college, not lower graduation rate. That is just one factor. It is not all factors. Mm-hmm. It is the character and a culture and a motivation of the person, and especially from the parents also. Especially Asians are deeply involved of their parents in helping financially and socially and morally. They are all behind of their children that attaining the higher education. So, to me, sometimes money is the big issue, but the character and then family involvement and motivation even bigger than the financial sectors. So I just want to share that thought.
Thank you, Representative.
Chair Representative, I think that's a good example of mentoring and, you know, having someone to really guide you through that process and encourage you to be able to gain these critical things. I absolutely agree. So,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you for your testimony.
There is some sociological data on why that happens, actually.
I'm sure there is.
That there are subcultural attributes that support this. For example, it's similar in several Asian cultures and in the Jewish culture. One is the independent love of knowledge, mm-hmm. independent of its ability to help you get somewhere. Some cultures start with, and there's all sorts of early education things about that. And another factor that's usually identified with some of the cultures is the cultural value that what one person in the family does reflects on the whole family.
Exactly.
And it gets families and to pool resources to help people get their way through, because it's a family thing rather than an individual thing. And there are several of some of the studies in the cultures that lead to this, and it's been going on in the Asian subcultures for at least 40 years of American study.
Thank you. You are right on.
Thank you, representatives. Just to note, since the previous panel did mention SOU, the SOU's report did come out yesterday on their cuts. They are able to keep their geology department. They are cutting German, and they are cutting staff positions. They're kind of like the canary in the coal mine, as far as I'm concerned. Gentlemen, welcome.
Chair Buckley and members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Joe Holliday, Vice President for Student Affairs and Enrollment Management at OIT, and thank you for this opportunity to address you today.
I'm Robert Mercer, Director of Enrollment Student Services, Oregon University System.
My name is Sheldon Nord. I'm the Vice President for Student Affairs at Eastern Oregon University. We've been invited as administrators to join the students today and try to give you a little bit of information about students in the Oregon University system. So our desire is just to help you get to know a little bit more about our students. Kind of our two specific goals for today is to talk about the role that student affairs as administrators we have with students. And I think of Representative Clem's comments about student learning outside the classroom. That's something we talk a lot about, because we know that some of us who look back 20, 30, whatever it is, years ago with our college experience, it's not necessarily the classes academically that we remember as being life-changing. It's some of the conversations in the hallways of the residence hall. It's those kinds of opportunities, intramural sports, being involved in a club like some people have talked about today. Those are the kind of things that we look back as kind of being life-changing and learning some of those transferable skills. The second goal, and most importantly, would be to just let you know a little bit more about Oregon University System students and some of the challenges that they face.
So just a little bit about the role of the Student Affairs Division and programs on our OUS campuses. We're a diverse group of professionals ranging from doctors, counselors, academic advisors, health professionals, coaches, mentors, service professionals, all trying to help students to be successful in and outside of the classroom. It is helpful to think of our services as a continuum of student success that begins with recruiting and admitting the students who can be successful in our programs in the first place, and I might add, increasingly partnering with K-12, community colleges, and other groups even further back in the pipeline to recruit the right students into our universities, ranging from transition services such as new student orientation, first-year experience programs. We want to be there when the students start to hit the bumps in the road. They'll have health issues, they'll have academic issues, they'll have student conduct issues, to be there for them that way. But to keep with them and keep following them and provide career guidance, academic advising, and to help them ultimately to be successful graduates of the Oregon University system. These are some typical student affairs functions. I won't read the list. They vary from institution to institution. For example, at the smaller regional so-called institutions and at OIT, the vice presidents also have responsibility for athletics, but these are the ones that mostly overlap among the seven institutions.
So the four examples that we have today, and this is certainly not an exhaustive list, but four examples of the kinds of issues that we deal with in helping students be successful. And hopefully these can generate some conversation today and questions from you. The first one, access and affordability issues, and information on this slide are not new to this committee or to legislators generally. We're all familiar with the challenges of cost and access. State support has not kept pace with the cost of utilities, health care, cost of living. Thus, significantly increased tuition results in either burdensome debt load for college graduates, or worse yet, families who simply do not have the financial resources to pursue higher education. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is helpful, and the new shared responsibility model is movement in the right direction. However, many of us are concerned whether it's enough to mitigate the impact of tuition increases of over 50% the last five years. Of course, the financial challenges are further complicated for first-generation and low-income students who bring other challenges as well. So looking at access and affordability, kind of looking at the campus response to that issue and some of the things that are happening.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Can I ask a question, please?
I'm going to try to let them go through their presentation, okay, if you can hold.
That'd be great. I'll try and keep up.
Thank you.
Place marker.
Please continue.
Okay. Just, I won't read through the slide again, but again, just to highlight a couple of examples to address these issues of access. We know that many of our high our admissions and financial aid staffs go to high schools and middle schools to help students and parents better prepare academically and financially for the college plans ahead. We know, I just wanted to highlight the University of Oregon Dean's Access Scholarship, which is some money that they've made available to help students in financial need. So I won't read other parts of this slide, but this is just some examples to kind of get your thinking about some of the access issues that campuses are trying to address.
And that brings us to a second set of issues that we wanted to highlight today, issues around academic preparation. It probably comes as no big surprise to you that some of our students come to us unprepared for our curricula. This is notable in mathematics, and it might be more on my mind as a representative of the Oregon Institute of Technology. Math preparation is key, but it's true across the board. You'll see there, for example, that there is a range of anywhere from 59% to 80% of our incoming freshmen are not ready for college math. And we know that because all of the institutions do a placement test for students to place them in a math class they can be successful in. It's not a screening method except to get them into the right math class. And I guess what that bullet tells me is that it's not some students, but rather it's the typical entering freshman who is not ready for college mathematics in Oregon University system. As you might know, we're trying to give you some campus-specific examples of the issue, but also some campus examples of how we're addressing the issues on our campuses. And this slide tells you about some of the campus initiatives. Many of the campuses we've highlighted, Eastern Oregon University and OSU in particular, who identify these at-risk students and place them into integrated studies and other types of programs. EOP stands for Educational Opportunity Program. OIT has a program of algebra review that allows students to get ready for Math 111, perhaps in time for the beginning of their freshman year. And I'll just mention, just very briefly as an aside, I was tracking on the conversation about TRIO grants during the student presentation, and I really want to echo what Courtney said about TRIO programs being a model for the universities, because they're small and personal, and if a small student-to-faculty ratio is correlated with quality instruction, I can tell you that it also highly correlates with quality student service.
We chose to also throw out a little bit of information here about the millennial generation. You may have heard of this, Millennial Rising. There's some books about this. When people who study generational issues, they talk about the baby boom generation and Generation X. And I took a couple slides out of a presentation that we do around campus with our faculty, with alumni, with our foundation board, and even with parents during the summer before their sons or daughter enroll, so that they learn a little bit about who our students are and the issues that they face. People who study these kind of things have identified 7 core traits of millennial students. And by the way, if you have millennial students, that means you also have millennial parents. And you may have heard of helicopter parents. These are parents who kind of hover around, and you have to help them exit when it's orientation weekend because they want to be pretty intrusive. And we talk with parents about this during our orientation sessions in the summer. So
the teachers refer to them as high maintenance.
High maintenance parents. There can be such a thing. And we have to deal with those gently.
Yes, we do.
I just put this slide up here. Just an example of those 7 core characteristics of millennial students. You see that they're sheltered. So here's an example of the kinds of things we as administrators need to think about as we work with our students. Think about the current generation of college students who in their lifetime, there's only been two presidents of the United States. They've experienced Columbine, 9/11. This is kind of a funny slide, but the reason it's funny, it's because it's got truth to it, right? This is a protected generation. Think about when your local town had to build a community playground. They had to make it so safe, and they have to put all this rubber. You couldn't get hurt if you tried, whereas some of us played on playgrounds with a rusty nail sticking up or a tin can. And I'm not proposing that we come go back to that, but think about the ramifications of students who go to college now who have had a safety net all of their life, and the risk-taking behavior And are they accustomed to weighing the cost of their behavior? It's a different set of circumstances than we had a generation ago. And as administrators, as we work with our faculty and our student activity staff and our student leaders, we talk about these issues because it's different than it was 15, 20 years ago. These are just a couple of comments that I really wanted in your handout more than anything, so I won't read through these. But this is some comments that people have made about the current millennial students, and you have them in your handout. And again, these are some implications for campus life about millennial students, and we can answer questions later if that's appropriate.
And the last set of issues that we wanted to briefly address this afternoon has to do with our increasingly diverse student body and the challenges that that presents for us in the student services areas. One of the most significant changes that we've seen over the last few years is the increase, almost doubling, of students with disabilities on our campuses. And as a subset of that, the almost tripling of students with so-called psychological disabilities, making psychological disabilities the third highest in incidence after learning disabilities and attention deficit disorder. Those types of disabilities present some very unique challenges to us in accommodating those disabilities, which is, of course, something that we are required to do and will do on all of the campuses. And again, some campus responses. Western Oregon University, for example, because they have the highest percentage of Latino Hispanic students in the system, they now have a bilingual preview day with a bilingual counselor, and some bilingual student leaders available throughout the day. There are some other examples there as well.
And we put this slide in here, Chair Buckley and others, so that you could just kind of see the other kinds of things we considered talking about today. We can answer questions about those things if you'd like. I want to applaud Melissa with the Oregon Student Association and Mike and Courtney today for their good work and their advocacy for students across the state. And with that, we'd like to open it up to any questions you might have.
Questions? Did you have?
Yeah, I was, and I'm even more intrigued than when I saw that early slide on the fact that there are more first-generation college students now. I mean, it doesn't sound like the millennium students. It sounds like the millennium students had parents that were much more likely to go to college than their parents had gone. And do we really have more first-generation, a higher proportion of first-generation students than we did 18 years ago?
Chairman Buckley and Representative Greenlick, at Eastern Oregon University, we are trying to get more of our students in that region to go to college. And as we try to increase the college-going rate, we're finding that an increasing percentage of our incoming students are first generation. That may be unique to Eastern. I'm not sure if that's – I couldn't speak to the rest of the system, but I would say that we're probably unique in some of those regards as we try to make higher ed more accessible to the smaller rural communities.
That's great.
I do believe we heard testimony previously that did say that there are actually fewer
overall.
But thank you. Representative Crowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. Dr. Nord, on the slide that says access and affordability student challenges, and it's the discussion of the grant funding, you mentioned the Oregon Opportunity Grant award covers only 11% of the cost of attendance. And yet, this biennium, we're going to have somewhere around $20 million left in that account that has not been awarded. I believe that the thought in Ways and Means is that's going to carry over and will be available for students for next year. But I'm concerned about, because in the 05 session, we heard how we needed to increase that fund. And in fact, we did. We moved it up to about, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was $80 million, and it had been $35 or $40 million before. So we really moved, put a lot of money into that. And now we're seeing that and through the e-board process, we also allowed for, not just the e-board process, last session, we also allowed for part-time students and community college students to be able to take advantage of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Are we doing all that we can to get students into the university system, either through in the community colleges or through the four-year universities, and so that we can actually utilize those dollars? Or is there another barrier that we have not recognized? Because, you know, quite frankly, if we're going to put the money into the account for students to be able to use, I want it to go out. I want the students to be able to use it. And I'd just like some input on that.
Chairman Buckley and Representative Kremel, I would like to just say that I share your concern. On a local level, we've talked a lot with our Director of Financial Aid and Financial Aid staff about it's a shame when the legislature steps up and then we're not able to distribute the money to needy students. So I share your concern. I don't know that I have my mind around all of those barriers to distributing that money, but I believe Robert has some more information than I do about that.
Chair Buckley, Representative Kremel. I think that there are a couple of issues going on, and one has to do with, as people have talked before, about the pickup rate in terms of the students who are eligible for money, but they're not eligible for enough to make a difference in terms of deciding to go to school or not. And that's a real challenge. But I think one of the issues, certainly for the university system, and it has to do with your part of the question about are we doing everything we can, as you noticed and you commented about the cuts to things like admissions and financial aid. So often, when cuts happen in those areas, what it means is the specifically required responsibilities of those offices are carried out. And the kinds of outreach functions that we all believe are so critical, but they're not either mandated by federal legislation and financial aid, or they're not required to process the paperwork to get students in, those are the kinds of things that suffer first. So going out to talk to students, first-generation students, and so on, about financial aid, about going to college, are some of the first things that we lose. And so often what we learn about first-generation students or students in a lower economic status has to do with their aspirations. And the aspiration that they don't believe they can afford to go to college, or they don't believe they are prepared to go to college. And often that's because they aren't aware of financial aid that's available or services that are available to them. And I guess that's a long way of saying we aren't doing enough, mm-hmm. but we're trying to figure out how do we provide those services in a time of severe cuts.
Representative McClain might want to join in here on this discussion.
And I apologize for not knowing the membership of our Education Ways and Means Sub currently. Do we have some members on this committee who are on the...
No.
Okay. So on the part-time question, it's accurate that the projections on who might pick it up didn't include a marketing plan, and so there's some concern that people didn't know about it because it was started mid-year. The full-time students, and I kind of went off on this once before, but I'm going to do it again here so everybody knows exactly why this happened. The 2005 Oregon legislature placed a budget note on the Oregon Student Assistance Commissioners denying them their statutory right to extend the either size of the grant or income eligibility. And so the legislature cost those students $14 to $20 million worth of scholarships. And just like you, I'm very angry, obviously, that it didn't get spent. It was the Oregon House and the Oregon Senate in their appropriations committees. I sat there. I warned them not to do it. They did it anyway. And then when I felt they should have lifted the budget note then, once they were doing it to protect from cost overruns. It turned out it was the other way. So what we wanted to do, and I wasn't even on OSAC at this point, we wanted to move that 11% up to like 15%. So we could spend the money? No. Okay, fine. Let's leave it at 11. Let's give it to some more kids. No. So of 10,000 or more, well, if the math, but several thousand students could have got an Oregon Opportunity Grant this last year, and a budget note of the legislature denied it. It wasn't marketing. It wasn't anything else. It was a political decision to try and control costs, and it had an unintended consequence of not allowing us to spend the money it was appropriated for, and nobody stepped up and did anything to fix it in the interim. And it was a tragedy, because I don't want to think about how many thousands of people could have got the grant. And we know from studies we've had before that one in three people who don't get the grant don't go to college. So take a third of the people who could have got the grant, and now they're not even in college this year because of a political error. Sorry.
Point well made, Representative.
I was just going to say I didn't completely have my mind around those issues, and it'd be better that he reported that than one of us reported that anyway. So,
yeah, you don't want to be accusing the legislature of anything, do you?
For the question,
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and thanks for the discussion on the grant. Hopefully, with the Aspire program and some other things, maybe we can remove some of those barriers. Dr. Holliday, on the it's the fourth page of your handout here, and at the top where the slide that talks about academic preparation and student challenges. There's two things there that are kind of bothering me a little bit, and I guess I would like to get some, because I teach at a high school, so I'd kind of like to get a little input here. The slide says academic under preparation. And then it's and then the other two lines that bother me, it says between 59% and 80% entering OUS students are not ready for college math, which is college algebra, which means they have to have taken at least geometry in high school. They've had to at least gotten to geometry to be able to get into college math. And then 32% of OIT student stopouts reported that math difficulty affected their ability to stay enrolled. And so, because in the admissions process, I know you look at transcripts, and you're looking to see what students have had, what grades they've had in the math and that sort of thing. Are we artificially passing students in math at Algebra 1, Geometry, Algebra 2 levels that shouldn't be being passed? Because, you know, we at the high school level, we want to be nice people, and we want to be liked by our students and, you know, all that other stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'm just, and then the generalized statement in terms of under preparation, what do we need to be doing at the high school level to make sure that kids are not underprepared, but that they are prepared? And maybe some of this millennial child stuff has something to do with it, too. But
thank you for that question, Representative Crummell. Chair Buckley and Representative Crummell and members of the committee, I don't have a very solid answer to that. I can tell you three things, I believe, though, in response to it. First, I believe that the colleges and the high schools have to continue to work together so that the two curricula match, so that we're all agreeing on what the student's level of ability is when they enter. The second thing I'll say is that one of the issues we have at OIT, and I think it's generalizable to the other state universities, is that the high school students a lot of times do not take their final math class in their senior year, so they're rusty. And by the time they get to us in the summer before freshman year, they're about a year plus away from their last math class. And the math placement tests their readiness at our college for Math 111, college algebra. It does not necessarily mean they have or haven't taken math classes of a certain type in the high school. So I think it's a timing thing. And third, I think that I do see evidence that there is what we call grade inflation. I mean, the student that has a 3.0 or better coming out of high school, and that is OIT's minimum grade point average coming out of high school, does seem to be less prepared, for example, in math than a comparable student in the past. So I think there might be some grade inflation. But I think as we move towards performance-based teaching and learning, I think we're going to solve that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. Appreciate your time. We have some representatives from the Oregon Community College. Just to note, while the Community College folks are coming up, the mention of millennials, the book Millennial Rising indicates that the millennial generation is the next savior generation for our country. So the pressure's on you guys.
Thank you, ma'am.
Be born in. it's people who come to college age around
after 2000.
Yeah, so you're part of it.
You're part of it.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, my name is Richard Levine. I am a lobbyist this session for the Oregon Community College Association. Prior to that, I was president at Rogue Community College for 5 years, and prior to that, I spent 20 years at community college, both at Rogue and at Chemeketa Community College. And 89 and 90, I was the assistant commissioner for community colleges. So instead of having three people, you've got me. I don't have a handout for you. I found out late yesterday I was going to testify in front of you, but I'd be glad to share with you my notes after the hearing. I had a choice of either driving up safely from Southern Oregon this morning or sitting there and typing with my computer on the other seat, and I chose to drive safely.
Thank you. Thank you.
Voice recognition.
Appreciate that.
If it only worked.
Yeah.
Thank you for allowing me to discuss student services with you. We have community colleges have just a little bit different story to tell. Our students are just a little bit different than the students at the university. The average age of our students is 34. Typically, 52-54%, depending on the college, are women coming back to school. Many of them are single heads of households and have one or two children that they're taking care of as they're going back to school. We have a higher population of minority students than the population you ordinarily find in your local communities. Typically, I'll just give you the example for Rogue Community College. Our Hispanic population is at about 15-16%. The community population is about 12% in the Rogue Valley. The same thing holds true at Chemeketa. Chemeketa's population of Hispanic students was much higher than the population within the community. That is a very positive thing. Many of those students come to us from high schools. They've got a high school diploma. They sometimes need English as a second language, but most of them come to us able to speak English perfectly. They've actually been born here in the United States and have grown up here. We also have, as part of our population, dislocated workers, unemployed workers, people who've been on unemployment for a long time. We have people who go back to school to acquire a whole set of new skills, so that they can improve themselves on their job. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because our student services activities have to cover a very broad spectrum of students and their own special needs. We are also what's called an open door system, which means we typically accept everyone who wants to come to college. We too have, as the universities do, a placement test to try to determine where students place in math, reading, and writing, and provide, I hate to say this, unfortunately, a very large department for developmental education to provide people with basic skills so that they're college ready. Many of our students do not come to us with all the skills they need for reading and writing and math. Our students have the same math anxieties as you heard the university people talk about, probably even more so. Many of them have not been in school for 20 years and are now coming back and have to do math, whether they're going to be an auto mechanic, a welder, or a transfer student. So we do have the same issue. If I could address Representative Crummell's question about students being prepared out of high school, it's not so much being prepared, it's being persistent. We have students who come to us with a 4.0 average right out of high school, and they have a hard time dealing with our writing and English classes. And the reason is our writing and English classes, typically you could have four or five papers due in a week. You could have reading assignments that are in 1 week or 2 weeks equivalent to what a student might get in high school for a semester. And so they're not quite used to being able to do the amount of work that's required at a community college or university as they had to do at a high school. We also don't provide them, and I think this is also key to be fair to the high schools, we also don't provide them with all of the activities that tend to drain some of the energy of those students away from their studies and into other kinds of activities. So I think in all fairness, that just has to be mentioned. Some of the services we have to provide because of this this wide, diverse group of students that we get, we have to provide services to veterans. We during the Vietnam War, we probably 40% of our population at community colleges in the 70s and early 80s were Vietnam vets. That still holds true today, not as large a population of coming back from both Iraq wars, and similar to Vietnam, but still it's a large population, and we do serve them and serve them well. The women who come to us who are coming out of a variety of different experiences, we develop programs called Women in Transition programs that help them get acclimated to the workplace. Many of them have never worked. Now they have to go to work. They need to be trained, but they also need some support mechanism as well. We train a lot of older workers. We train a lot of folks that, hate to say it, are my age, that are still looking for a job because they've been laid off. It doesn't matter if it's in Southern Oregon, it doesn't matter if it's in Corvallis, it doesn't matter if it's in the Willamette Valley. When someone gets laid off, they're looking for a way to recapture their income, and they need skills to be able to do it. They come to us, and we provide a whole variety of services. One of those services is called Bridge Programs. When students come to us and they have a limited amount of time to get out, they don't want to take all of those basic skill classes to help them read and then take the program classes. So many colleges have devised a parallel system to allow those students to be in programs, but also to take those courses that are going to help them build up the skill level they need to be successful. Good example of that, the reading grade level for an automotive textbook is right around the 14th grade level. And so if you've been out of school a while, have a problem with comprehension, being able to read, and you find yourself in a program where you think you're going to be changing spark plugs, you're probably going to have quite a bit of difficulty in trying to get through that program. There's a lot of physics involved nowadays in the automotive programs. We too, at community colleges, you heard the students talk about TRIO programs. Most of our colleges have federally funded TRIO programs to help first-time students, students who come from who are minority students, a whole variety of students that that need help. And then, of course, we have a counseling and advising, and we have a problem in our student services when we talk about counseling. I'll give you an example. At Rhode Community College, we have 8 full-time counselors. Our headcount, when I left, was 16,500 students. It would be almost impossible for a counselor to be able to have a student, every student assigned to a particular counselor. So what community colleges have done is enlisted our faculty. Our faculty are advisors to students. They have a list of students that they advise. Most of them are within their transfer area or their program area, but they participate in the whole counseling and advising process. The other thing that a lot of colleges have done is to develop their student cadre, as we call them, student assistants, and they help in the student services area, and they provide help with financial aid, they help with counseling and advising students into courses. So it's a wide array of services, but certainly, as you've heard from the university folks as well as the students, we're not overstaffed when it comes to having people in student services. Budget shortfalls always hit student services first, and you asked the Representative Crummell the question about the student coming in and trying to market students, and if you don't have enough people up front, how are you going to be able to deal with that? Well, you have to try to deal with it as best as you can. All of us are on what's called the FTE model. We need those students coming through the door. What most of the community colleges have done, and I could speak to both Shemecketa and Rogue Community College, we developed 2 types of system, a people system and then our information systems to help in this process. I talked to you a little bit about how we use faculty and students as counseling and advisors. But we also have integrated our services. Our clerical staff, when you go into an admissions office, can admit you, register you, and do your financial aid, help you with your financial aid. So instead of having one person assigned each one of those tasks, everyone is cross-trained so that in peak periods they can swap out and help that influx of students get registered and get their financial aid in order. The second part of this is I think we've been fairly creative on how we developed our computer systems. It's fairly standard now for a student to register via the internet. They can, if they've been a student before, taken their placement test, they can go online and register for their classes and then show up the first day. There's even a way for them to pay for their tuition if they want to use a credit card. If they have financial aid, that's also built into the system, so the system knows they have financial aid. And so they can register after the first time and pretty much after that be able to register. Tied into that is also what's called the degree completion systems. Because we're short on counselors, if you're in your last year and ready to transfer, you really want to know if you've fulfilled all the requirements to get your associate degree and the courses that you need to actually transfer. Well, all of our counselors and advisors have a system that's designed to pull that up on the screen, a student's records up on the screen, and have it matched with their transcript so the students know what courses are missing from their particular degree requirements. All of that means that they see fewer people. Unfortunately, systems aren't perfect, and if you don't have enough people, and with all of the budget cuts in all the systems, we know we don't, you have students falling through the cracks, and you as representatives hear about that. I'm sure you've got constituents who call you and say, my son Johnny went to a community college and took these classes, and they told him he was going to transfer. He went to the university, and they don't transfer. Well, they sometimes don't, depending on what that student took and what program they want to transfer into. That very well could be a true statement. It also could be a statement that Johnny really didn't take the class that he needed to take. He took an easier class, and that didn't transfer to the higher education system. One of the other things that we've done that I think helps students, sometimes when you have budget cuts, necessity is the mother of invention. Rogue Community College developed what's called a paperless financial aid system. We have four campuses, and if a student got their financial aid in the Grants Pass campus but was taking classes over in Medford or in White City and they wanted to find out the status of their financial aid, typically colleges keep a paper process of all of the financial aid applications, where the student is, what are the issues. Rogue instituted a paperless system where everything is in the computer system. After the student makes out their first application, it goes into the system, and thereafter every piece of paper goes in. And if a student goes 40 miles away and wants to find out what their financial aid situation is, they can get that at any one of the terminals in the financial aid registration or admissions office. I mentioned I'm just going to go through some issues, and the good thing about not having handouts is you're not going to be able to question any of my numbers, but I'm not going to throw very many at you. Counselors are an issue. Having eight counselors for 16,500 students is a huge problem. Students don't get that personal service that they should get. Has it been a problem? Will it be a problem? The answer is yes. We will never have as many counselors per students, but we will have as many teachers as we need per students. We keep our student ratio, faculty-student ratio, as best we can to one faculty member for 20 students. That's a lot different than what we do with counselors. One of the other the special programs that have been mentioned, like TRIO, Women in Transition programs, they can only pick up a certain number of students that have a need to have this type of service. And we're talking 2 to 3 dozen students out of a student population at a particular college, because that's all the money the federal government gives us. Or in some of these programs, Women in Transition programs, you fund part of it, the federal government funds part of it, but there's still only so many students that can be helped within these programs. So The issue for us there is how do we help those dislocated workers, women coming back into school, a student who is ill-prepared to be a college student. When dollars are short, those types of services tend to be the ones that don't get as much money as they need to. I mentioned the testing issues. Probably gives us the biggest problem, as Representative Clem knows, in his relationship to financial aid. You need a placement system in place that is fair to everyone, that enables federal financial aid to be dealt with equitably to all students. However, many students do not believe their scores when they take the placement test. And they would love to be in a college-level class and have to be dissuaded to maybe take a class at a lower level so that they can pass that college-level test. For older students, it's extremely discouraging. If you're a 35, 40-year-old person being told you have to take, and you went through high school, you had the classes, but now 20 years later you're in school, you're back in college, and you're told you're going to have to take a beginning math class before you take that algebra class, it's deflating. So we've tried to figure out how to deal with some of those issues, and I mentioned the Bridge program as one of the ways to allow students in programs but also provide them with the skills at the same time in parallel to what they need. I'm almost done. The retention issues at community colleges, as you heard the students talk about, are really one of those issues that we would like to fund more than we're able to. If you look at a business model, you try to keep your customers. You don't try to keep getting new customers all the time. You'd like your customer to be there for us for 2 years because they're going to pay tuition for 2 years. And then they'll go to the university or they'll go to work. But for us, when you have students who have money problems or they have skill problems and you're trying to keep them in school, if you don't have the resources to do that, it's extremely difficult to keep them there. The number one reason people talk about dropping out of a community college is money. It's economics. How long can they stay in school full time or even three quarter time and still be able to manage a family, be able to provide for their children and still go to school? It's easier for them to figure out sometimes than it is for us. So it's an extremely important issue for full funding. I have to plug that, to make sure that we can continue to provide those kinds of services as well as to improve on them. Representative Krummel asked, how much was the state contribution to all of this? And it was specific, I think, to student services. Before Measure 5, the state contributed about 52% of community college revenue. It's down to about 30%. The difference now is student tuition. So students now pay more into the system than the state does. The balance is paid for out of property taxes. And so now it's almost equal. About a third, with discrepancies depending on funding formulas as to which college is paying more into the system of property taxes than into getting money from the state. An issue that Representative Lim brought up, I've got two examples I'd like to quickly mention because I think he was right on some of the cultural issues. It isn't just poverty, it isn't just money. When I retired as president, I became the director of the Rogue Community College Foundation. And we had a young woman working in our office who lived out in Cape Junction. And she was homeschooled. Her parents fought her about going to college. So they did not want her to go to a liberal college that was going to do whatever to her. They were dead set against it. And she was determined to go to college and get a degree. She stayed as a chemistry major at Rogue, got a full scholarship at Washington, University of Washington, and because not only of her circumstances but her grades and the type of student that she was, they even offered her a scholarship for a master's degree. Now, this is a student who had not yet completed her associate degree. Her parents obviously were still against her going to now the university in the state of Washington. But she went anyway and has been quite successful. She communicates back to the foundation all the time. Her brother who is 4 years younger, is now at Rogue Community College. He saw how successful she was, and so he is now attending Rogue Community College. In the heyday of the timber industry, there was a great article in the Grants Pass newspaper written by a 16-year-old student. And at that time, they were trying to mandate that you could not drop out of school unless you had your parents' signature, and it was a very difficult process for mandatory attendance. There's a letter to the editor who wrote about the fact that his father and his grandfather, his great-grandfather, worked in the woods from the time they were 16 years old on. And that's what his intention was, too. And he really did not need to go to high school and complete high school to be able to be successful and to be working out in the community, and dropped out. I happened to be around 10 years later, and that student did finally come back to school because, as you know, the timber industry not too long ago, but long enough ago that this student was impacted, what became now almost non-existent in Southern Oregon. And so now he's in school, and this was several years ago. This was almost 10 years ago that I met him. And 10 years ago, he was starting all over again. He had to deal with basic skill level. He dropped out when he was 16 and had to be able to then get his skill level up so he could take college classes, and was very happy to do that. But he came from a whole line of people who did not believe in college. And you're right, Representative Lim. It's very difficult for students if they don't have a support mechanism, if they don't have the ability to have their parents, their spouse, someone helping them, march through this process, because it's a difficult economic process to go through, as well as a time-consuming process, but one in which you can be very successful. My last comment is, as a body, this group and the governor over the years has provided state support for community colleges. This year, community colleges are asking for close to a little over $500 million in state support. Let me just put this to you. When you think in your minds as to the major workforce provider of the state, you have a $500 million investment in community colleges. We provide, from the student who wants to transfer to the student who is going into a logging program or a truck driving program, a student who wants to be successful, every one of our students is going to a community college, for the most part, to find a job, to improve their skill level, and to get a better job. What better investment can you make than providing that to your major workforce provider in the state of Oregon? That is a commercial, by the way. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Any questions, Jim?
I was going to give him softballs to get us on the 529 topic, but he didn't need him.
He was there ahead, way ahead of you. Rick, thank you so much. Thanks for driving up carefully.
Thank you.
And thanks for being here today. Well, that, gentlemen, we've learned about student services, and appreciate your time and attention. We'll close this committee hearing. See you next week.